Let's cultivate our motivation and really rejoice that we have this opportunity to hear the Dharma. So often we take our contact with the Dharma for granted and squeeze it in amongst other various important aspects of our life. But at the time of death, it's the Dharma practice that's really going to matter, because our Dharma practice is what will enable us to have a subdued mind, a focused mind, a mind with virtuous thoughts at the time of death. And so because we're creatures of habit, we need to habituate ourselves with the kind of thoughts we want to have at the time of death, to habituate ourselves with them now. And so therefore we really appreciate the opportunity we have to hear the teachings and habituate ourselves in that way. And one of the main thoughts we want to habituate ourselves with is the aspiration for full enlightenment in order to benefit all living beings. So it's a very lofty and noble aspiration, but it's something extremely worthwhile and meaningful for ourselves and others. And therefore, no matter how long it takes to attain full enlightenment, let's keep going in that direction with lots of enthusiasm and joy. So some of you may remember that when I was living in Seattle before, whenever I went away on a trip, when I came back, I would tell you about what happened. Do you remember? Mm-hmm. So I thought I would do that tonight because I just came from the 14th Western Monastic Western Buddhist Monastic, I don't know what order all the words come in, conference. And it was just really wonderful. And I think these kind of meetings we've been having are quite remarkable and very important, actually, for the spread of the Dharma. So I thought I would share some of that with you. The series of meetings started back in 1994, and it was one nun's idea, you know, that we just get together and talk about issues of common things. So in the first couple of meetings, it was just a few people, most of us from the Tibetan tradition, because the nun who had the idea was from the Tibetan tradition. The invitations we extended to other Buddhist monastic groups started to pay off. And so, for example, the folks from Shasta Abbey, which is a Zen monastery in Northern California, they began to come. And then the people from Abhayagiri, which is a Theravada monastery, also in Northern California, they began to come. And then the people from the Dharma Realm Buddhist Association, that is Master Shenhua, City of 10,000 Buddhas, you know, his people from his group, they began to come. And then, of course, you know, some people from Gumpo Abbey and all sorts of, you know, different organizations, they began to come. And so now, whenever we have these meetings, we have a cutoff point of, you know, what the maximum, like, so that we can maintain some, you know, proximity of intimacy without having such a huge group. And the meetings are just fantastic. Because if you think about it, you know, historically, as Buddhism spread, you know, to so many different countries, these countries were isolated geographically. You know, Sri Lanka was an island, Southeast Asia, you had, you know, the Mekong and different rivers, you know, flowing through, and travel wasn't so easy. Then you had the Himalayas and the Karakoram Mountains between India and Central Asia, because Buddhism used to flourish in Central Asia. Yeah? And then I went to China and Japan and Tibet and Korea and all over the place. And, you know, the people who practiced it didn't have the opportunity so much to talk to each other. They didn't have cell phones and, you know, email and these kinds of things. And so, you know, the Buddhism kind of grew up in all these different countries in a somewhat insular way. But nowadays, because of technology, we have the ability to meet each other and to come together and talk. And the Asian masters do that somewhat, but not so much. I mean, they weren't raised as in the way that we're raised here in the West, with, you know, plurality and diversity and interfaith dialogue. And I heard a new term today, interspiritual dialogue, which I think is a nice term. But they weren't raised with that. Whereas in the West, you know, those of us who grew up here were. And so the idea of people coming together, you know, from different Buddhist traditions and talking and meeting is something that's very much part of our culture and that we want to do, even though, you know, our Asian ancestors or our Asian teachers are not, you know, don't do that so much. And especially in the West, where in one country you have so many different Buddhist traditions, it isn't like, you know, in Tibet, where it was, you know, although they have different traditions within Tibetan Buddhism, still it's, you know, Tibetan Buddhism, it's, you know, which is different from other forms. So here we have such a diversity, and we all speak English. So it's quite an incredible thing that happens when you think of the Sangha from all these traditions coming together in harmony and discussing. Well, I think it's pretty amazing. Actually, His Holiness Dalai Lama mentioned to me once that he has more contact with Christians and Jews and Muslims and people from other traditions than he does with other Buddhists. Isn't that phenomenal? You know? But meanwhile, here in the West, we're having these conferences. So this is the 14th. This one's been going on for some time. And of course, in the beginning, you know, we were just getting to know each other and learn about each other's traditions and how you practice and how you meditate and things like that. And now, many of the same people have been coming back year after year after year. And so there's a core group of people at the conferences, and we know each other pretty well. And we also, when the conference isn't going on, we very often act as a support group for each other. Okay? So, for example, when I needed a copy of the Bhikshu Pratimoksha translated from Chinese, I knew exactly who to write to, you know. And, you know, I had to write to a few people before I eventually got it. Yeah, because, it, you know, most people didn't have a translation. But, you know people to write to. And in setting up Srivasti Abbey, you know, these meetings that we've been having have really influenced me, because I've heard how the other monasteries and abbeys are set up and how they practice, how their schedule, how they're administered, and so on. And so it's really given me a lot to draw on in setting up the abbey, because I feel like I've been able to see the best in all the different traditions and pull it out and, you know, put it together in making the abbey. So I think it's pretty exceptional having this group of people together. And especially the first generation of Western Buddhist monastics, because, you know, after a religion has existed for a while in a country, it becomes part of the culture, and then sometimes things get a little slack and so on. But the first generation, it's like people are really trying to do it right. Yeah. You know, whether we do or not is another question. But, you know, we really want to learn it. We want to do it right. And so we're also learning from each other in the process of doing this, as well as from our Asian teachers. So I thought I would just share with you a little bit about the topics we talked about, so you would get an idea of the depth of conversation that we have. You know, because at the beginning we didn't know so much about each other, so we were learning, and, you know, once in a while people would get defensive. There was never any quarreling or anything, but, you know, everybody would feel like they would have to say, well, in our tradition we do it this way. But now it's like we don't do that because we're already friends, you know? And some of the people have even taught at each other's monasteries and temples. So the friendship is there, and so that there isn't the need anymore to make sure that, you know, everybody understands every detail of our tradition, right? That we, you know, get rid of all those wrong conceptions you have. You know, we aren't so worried about that now. So the theme of the conference, what was the theme? It was about monastic training, monastic life in the West. And so we talked a lot about our various monasteries and you know, the training and so forth and so on. So there was one panel on the first day that was quite interesting. It was on the four requisites. And so the four requisites that we need to stay alive: food, clothing, shelter, and medicine. Yeah. And so traditionally in Buddhism, it's the way the Buddha set it up, it's been the lay people who should provide the four requisites for the Sangha, and the Sangha provides the leadership and counseling and Dharma teachings for the lay people. So there's been that reciprocal situation in the past. But that isn't the way it is necessarily nowadays, you know? And also, especially coming into America, where people don't know what Buddhism is. They don't know what Buddhist monastics are and, you know, how they live and, you know, stuff like that. Then it can be a real challenge. So there was one presentation by the people, some people from the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives. They're the Shasta Abbey people. But this was one of their priories that was located an hour outside of a city in California, and talking about how they got their four requisites. Yeah, and so they had, you know, a group of lay people who, you know, give them things, and you really develop a sense of contentment. Whatever people bring, you're content with that. Yeah. And sometimes they bring what you like, and sometimes they don't. And sometimes they bring a lot, and sometimes they don't. And so the Theravada monasteries are set up in that same way. People will bring groceries. Very often they'll bring cooked food, or the lay people will cook the food. In the Tibetan monasteries, and in some of the Chinese monasteries, they go out and buy the food. Although many times, especially in the Chinese temples, the lay people will bring food to the temple. But in the Tibetan Dharma centers, not so much. And so in this conversation of the four requisites was quite interesting, because you had this whole diversity of how people covered their medical, you know, food, clothing, and living costs. So in some situations, you know, it was provided and people brought the food, or they donated money to the temple. In some situations, especially presentation by one Tibetan nun, it's like she's now out working, you know, and got a job. The job is a Dharma type of job, you know, it's in hospice work. But, you know, she has to support herself, and she just had a lot of medical bills, and she has to come up with the money somehow to do that, or, you know, so it was quite a big diversity in how that's happening. And so the whole discussion of how do you convey the monastic to people in the U.S. who have no idea about it. Yeah, or maybe their idea of monastic lifestyle is the Catholic model, where you have your little cottage industry and you make wine or fruitcake or chocolate, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah, I remember visiting a Catholic nunnery and they were a winery. That's how they earn their living. Well, and I kind of had to explain in Buddhism we can't do that, you know. We don't drink, you know. And in terms of fruitcake, you know, I've always had the theory that there's one fruitcake that one person gives to the other, who gives it to the other, who gives it to, you know? The fruitcake just kind of goes around. Yeah. So it's quite interesting because you had this one Tibetan nun who, you know, nun in the Tibetan tradition who is doing, you know, has a job. Then there's another monk in the Tibetan tradition who makes canoes because he has to earn a living, and so he was making them and selling them. And then just this whole variety of things in between. And you have some of the monastics who drive and some of them who don't. Yeah? And so different, you know, monasteries have been set up with, you know, different takes about transportation. So that was quite interesting. And then that evening we had a discussion about how we relate to our Asian teachers and the Asian traditions from which we came. Yeah. And so, you know, many of you have never been to India, for example, never seen Tibetan Buddhism in India, or never seen Tibetan Buddhism in Tibet. Yeah. And so you're not so aware of the different kind of issues that we have of maintaining a close contact with our Dharma ancestors, and yet coming to a new country and setting up like a Dharma center. They don't have Dharma centers in India. They have monasteries. Okay? And there's monasteries, and the monks and nuns live in the monasteries, and then the lay people come and visit them, but there's no Dharma centers where lay people go. Okay, so the whole idea of a Dharma center is really something new. It's something different that we've done here. Yeah, and also the whole issue of accreditation. You know, how you become a teacher in the West. Do the teachers in Asia certify you? Do you have what kind of connection do you have with the Asian traditions? And it's very, very interesting. I mean, because also some of the Asian traditions, it's not like the Catholic Church that's so well organized. I mean, in Tibetan Buddhism, there's no central certifying body that says you're a teacher. You know, people come and ask you for teachings, you become a teacher. That's it. Yeah? And there's no certifying body. And then you have this whole thing of, you know, some teachers coming who are Tibetan who teach and who want all the chanting and everything to be in Tibetan language. And then you have the Western teachers who want things to be in English. And then you have this interesting kind of racism in the Western Dharma centers, where Western students think that if you are Tibetan or Asian, you know, if you're Asian, and especially if you're a man, then you must be spiritually very high. Yeah? And so all this respect is accorded to the Asian teachers, no matter whether they might even be sometimes young monks who haven't studied a lot, but they're over here. But, you know, we have kind of this mystique, yeah? Whereas people who grew up in America, you know, we kind of look around, what do you know? You know, you watched Mickey Mouse like I did, and you know, what do you know about the Dharma? And so we have this mind that wants something exotic, and, you know, almost the less you understand, the more they speak another language, so the less you understand, the more exotic it must be. Yeah? So you have that interesting kind of dynamic, you know. And then also how the Asians welcome the Western Buddhists. And there's such a diversity. You know, for example, in the Thai tradition or in the Sri Lankan tradition, the Westerners who are ordained, they're completely welcomed into the monasteries. They are supported. They are well respected. They are given titles. You know, they're really very well integrated and respected and you know, made a part of the Buddhist institutions in the Theravada countries. In Chinese Buddhism, my experience has been, especially if you join and you learn Chinese, then it's just wonderful. I mean, because most of the Chinese temples in the U.S. still rely a lot on Chinese language. Yeah, but even if you don't speak Chinese, I know when I've been to Taiwan, you know, they're very, very happy to see Western monastics. And I remember one time arriving at a temple, and they were just about ready to take their picture of a graduating class, you know, people who had been studying for a while. And I was new, I arrived, but I was Sangha, and they just put me right in the picture, you know, with all the teachers of the class. Yeah. And Venerable Wu Yin, who some of you know, she was the one who taught life as a Western Buddhist nun. When I saw her in Hamburg this last summer, she said to me, "You Western nuns are very qualified. I would, if it were my thing to do, I would give you all a temple to run." Because she was very surprised at how the Tibetan teachers, you know, just kind of didn't take a lot of interest in the Western nuns. Yeah? And in the West, you know, among the Tibetans, it's very interesting. There seems to be more of the feeling that the Tibetans are the ones who really do it right. Yeah, and we kind of tag along. Yeah? It's very interesting, you know, because I've never felt like I've been made a part of the Tibetan religious institution, whereas, like my friends in Thai Buddhism, they're very definitely a part of their mother country religious institution. Then, some of the people from the Soto Zen tradition from Japan, they were talking, and they've had, like, all sorts of things, like we did, you know, it's like the headquarters in Japan would certify their temple, but only if it had a Japanese master. So their master, who was Western, she could be still the abbess, but they had to have a Japanese master who's, you know, the actual abbot of it. So they didn't join the Soto sect in Japan. You know. And so, you know, similarly, different requirements for certifying them as ordained priests. So, you know, you can really see the cultural thing that's happening here. You know, as we have two different cultures coming together who think in different ways. And especially if like in the case of the Tibetans, they don't have their own country anymore. So there's certain issues that make them much more conservative. You know, and I don't know why the Japanese were so conservative, but whatever, you know. I mean, so you have different cultural issues that play into this. So it's really quite interesting, quite a fascinating discussion we had. And of course, all of us expressing our feelings about how do we feel about being included or not included in the religious institutions. So for example, for me, for many years at the beginning, it was actually quite hurtful, you know, because it was very clear, I could come to teachings, but I was never going to be part of Tibetan Buddhism, and, you know, and yet I had such a strong heart connection, and so I felt excluded. But then, as time went on, I actually began to see that this was a plus point, because in terms of the situation of the nuns, they don't have full ordination, the lineage of ordination for the women in Tibet. in Tibetan Buddhism, but they do have it in Chinese Buddhism. It's very hard for the Tibetan nuns to go to Taiwan to take the ordination back and live in Tibetan society, where, you know, the Tibetans are not real keen on taking things from the Chinese, unless the Chinese want to give them back their own country, you know. But in terms of taking a lineage, you know, so it's very difficult for the Tibetan nuns to do that. They would face many obstacles, whereas we Western nuns, they don't care what we do. We're not part of them, you know. So I asked His Holiness if I could go. He said, yes, I went, you know. I can set up the abbey the way I want to because, you know, they don't care what I'm doing. And so, yeah, I mean, from my side, I try to remain very faithful to the tradition as much as I can, you know, especially to the teachings, because you can't improve at all on the Buddhist teachings. You know. But in terms of how we're running the abbey, we're doing it with a much more Western organizational structure, and we're having full ordination for women. You know, we're taking the Chinese lineage and having it. So, you know, nobody from the Tibetan tradition is going to bother me about that. Yeah, because I'm not part of them. So it actually, you know, in the end, it turned out kind of nice that way. And yet still, you know, I just love when my teachers come to the abbey and teach and share the Dharma, and the Dharma teachings will follow exactly from the tradition. Mm-hmm. And then, let's see, so that was the first day. The second day, what did we talk about? Oh, the first session, people were talking about how the training happens. And so there it was also very interesting to see the diversity, because in the Thai forest tradition, because those were the, you know, there's many different Thai traditions. This was the Thai forest tradition. They, in the monastery, in terms of Vinaya, the precepts and the monastic discipline, they're very strict, and everybody keeps it very strictly. And that's what really glues the community together. But in terms of your meditation practice, you're given a lot of leeway. And so some people are doing mindfulness of breath. Some people might even do Chenrezig meditation. Yeah? There can be a whole diversity in their monasteries of the actual meditation practice, because it's the Vinaya that really, you know, that they emphasize that is their practice as a community. Okay? In the Chinese tradition, it's a little bit different, because usually at a monastery you have your Vinaya, which keeps you together, but also your way of practice keeps you together. So you might have a Chan monastery, or what you find more now is a monastery that practices Chan, that's Zen, and Pure Land together. You know, you'll find them doing both of the practices. So the people do the practice together, they, you know, and keep the Vinaya together. In the Tibetan tradition, usually you do pretty much the same practices together. Although it was quite interesting, there was one abbess from a newly forming Tibetan nunnery on the East Coast, and she was stressing, because in her tradition, the people go into tantric practice fairly soon, and so she was emphasizing that people really get their individual deity practice very early on, and so the practice is very individual from that point of view, and yet very communal in the sense that you do some practices together. So it's quite interesting to see, you know, where do you keep Vinaya together, where the monastic code together, where do you practice together, who does it in which way, you know, and the diversity. And then in the afternoon, there was talk about creating Western monasteries. Yeah. And so I was on this panel, and we talked so long in the afternoon that I had to give my presentation in the evening, because we got into so much discussion about it. It was really quite interesting. There was The first presentation was by Reverend Hengsher. He's from the Dharma Dharma Realm Buddhist Association, Master Shenhua. And he has a monastery center type of thing in Berkeley. It's called the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. And he is right in the middle of the city, and they open their doors in the morning, like at 6 a.m., for people to come in and meditate, and then they close it, you know, after meditation. And then in the evening, they open again for meditation, and then they have teachings and different Dharma events and things in the evening. And so they get all kinds of people there. And a lot of young people, because it's Berkeley. And he was saying, because, you know, it came up a lot as we were talking, because Shasta Abbey, the place where the conference was held, they only have, they have a monastic community of about 25, and only three of them are under 50. Yeah, it's an aging, I think they said three under 50, and maybe it was three under 40, but, you know, something, most everybody was over 50. And whereas, you know, with this, in the temple in Berkeley, then they were getting a lot of young people. So we got into a big discussion about what attracts young people. And, you know, besides the rock and roll. And, but, you know, what Reverend Hengsher's idea was that the monastery was a safe place for them to come and really look at their mind, because they knew that, especially for the women, that none of the guys were going to hit on them. You know? And that they could just come there, think, use their mind, and they didn't have to worry about flirting and this and that and all that kind of stuff. You know? And so for young people who are really interested in looking within, you know, the monastery, the center, provided a safe place for that. I thought that was fascinating. I never thought of it that way, but I think it's probably true. Although I must say, there's some couples that I'm quite close to, because they met in my teachings, you know. So I guess it doesn't always hold true. But you remember Peter, who came to DFF, his wife Jessica. They, you know, they met at a retreat that I was leading in Mexico. So, anyway, enough of that. Reverend Master Echo. He's the abbot of the Soto Zen Center. You know. And so all these people are Westerners. There were a few Asians at the conference, but mostly Westerners. And he brought up a fascinating topic of, what about a Western Vinaya? You know, the Vinaya is the monastic code. And, you know, in the different traditions, we keep the Vinaya, even in our home countries, in our mother countries, people keep the Vinaya differently. And then when you have Vinaya moving to the West, where the culture is completely different, and also not only the culture but the time period, because so many of the precepts were made, I mean, you know, was suited for India 26 centuries ago. Yeah, so it's, our culture is very different now. And so is there a chance for us to come up with a Western Vinaya? Now, it's an interesting question, because there's this whole story in all of our Vinaya traditions that the Buddha, right before he passed away, said, you know, that the Sangha can change some of the minor precepts. But Ananda, his attendant, forgot to ask him which were the minor precepts. I mean, it's kind of, if you think, you can figure it out. But anyway, you know, it wasn't specifically listed. So then, you know, most of our traditions just feel like, well, you can't change anything, because this was the word of the enlightened one. We aren't enlightened. Who are we to change anything? Okay. So you keep everything like it is, And then you have like the Theravada forest tradition, which is very strict, you know, and so they don't handle money, they don't cook, they, you know, many things like that. And then you have other traditions that have made certain adaptations. For example, when Buddhism went to China, to avoid the politics in the city, many of the monastics, this was centuries ago, moved to the mountains. When you move to the mountains, then you have to grow your own food because you can't go with your owl. Yeah? So they were digging in the earth and working the land, which actually in Vinaya you're not supposed to do. Okay? But you can see why they did it. They had kind of a good reason, didn't they? You know, in the Tibetan tradition, they, and also in the Chinese tradition, but more in the Tibetan tradition, they handle money. And they had so many thousands of monks that if all the monks, you know, were to go on Pindapat in the city, I mean, the townspeople would go broke trying to feed them because there were a quarter of the male population in old Tibet were monks, you know. So they handled money and they buy food and so on. So you have all these different adaptations made. Now, what does all this mean with Buddhism coming to the West? How are we going to do it here? Because the Theravada folks, they live outside of Ukiah, and once a week now, they will go on Pindapat in Ukiah, and they'll go with their alms bowls, and the people now know that they're coming, and they'll come out and give them alms. You know, isn't that cool? The city of 10,000 Buddhas, which is also located in Ukiah, they've never gone in and done that. Yeah? And I haven't tried it at the Abbey yet. You know, I would like to do it. I think it would be really nice. When the Theravadas started doing it, they had their lay supporters who knew about it, who were in the town, and who knew the route they were taking and who came and gave them food. And then gradually some of the people in the town were saying, well, what are you doing? Of course, you had to go to the town and apply for a permit, you know, to have a parade. Yeah? You know, and there's regulations, and you can't block the street, and you can't, you know, block the entrances to the shops or things like that. So, you know, you have to get a permit to do it. So the folks at Shasta Abbey, they got inspired by this at one of our previous conferences. So now they go into the town of Shasta, I think once a week. Yeah. And they have the custom in Japan, they ring a bell, yeah, to let the people go, know that they're coming. So initially it was their own, the people who would come to the center who would give them food. And then gradually the people in the town began to also give them food. So someday I want to do this in Newport. Yeah? So all of you may need to come out there and stand on the street and, you know, explain to people what we're doing. But it's neat because it's an age-old custom, and it's, you know, food is such a basic thing about our lives, isn't it? You know, and the sharing of food. So, it's an incredible way to kind of make contact with people. One time when I was in Oregon, the Shoto Zen people, the priests, were going out on alms round, and I went with them. And it was just, it was wonderful. We were walking up and down this major thoroughfare in Portland, and they had sent out a little notice to all the people on the route, letting them know, you know, and the businesses. And so, you know, we would see the head nun walked in front, and they, you know, ring a bell, and we had the big, you know, Japanese hats like this, and our bowls, and then, you know, some of the stores, the people would come out. There was an Asian restaurant, they came out and gave us food, different people. When we were walking past the liquor store, you know, it was like, I think somebody came out from the store next door, so we wanted to make sure that we were in front of the store next door, not in front of the liquor store when we stopped. Yeah. And then there were lay people who were with us, and so when our bowls got filled, then we gave the food to them, and then they had a vehicle, and, you know, they put it in the car. But it was a wonderful way to do that, and these people who aren't Buddhist came and offered food, and then we did like a little blessing prayer for them afterwards. So it's just such a nice way of making contact with people. So all these different Vinaya issues of, you know, how do we do that? And then the people in Thich Nhat Hanh's group, they actually developed their own Western Vinaya. They studied the traditional one, but then, you know, Thay also developed a Western one, and it has all sorts of rules about driving and rules about the internet. Yeah? And so I think it's fascinating. I think, you know, at the Abbey, what we're going to do is, you know, because I want to keep the link with our mother tradition, so we're not going to change any of the Vinaya precepts, but we're going to have our own in-house precepts. Yeah? And so I think, I mean, definitely if the Buddha were alive now, we would have precepts regarding recycling. Yeah? We would have regarding the internet, regarding driving, you know, all these different sorts of things that, you know, they didn't even have back in those times. So I think it's fascinating to try and think, well, let's take the Buddhist principles and the kind of lifestyle the Buddha wanted his students to live, and then let's apply that to our lifestyle now. Yeah? So, for example, like in the Theravada tradition, they don't drive. Yeah, I'm not sure why. Yeah, we do in our Vinaya, we actually have a precept not to ride in vehicles. The reason for that was that in ancient times, the vehicle would be pulled by either a person or an animal who would be stressed by it. And because they didn't have so many vehicles, if you rode in one, you were really upper class, and there was a big possibility of getting quite arrogant. And so the Buddha said, you know, unless there's an emergency, the monastics can't ride in vehicles. So how do you update that now, where in order to give a Dharma teaching, you have to ride in the vehicle? Okay? So the Theravadas don't drive, the Tibetans and the Chinese do drive. Now there's all sorts of also different considerations, because I've thought about this a lot. On one hand, I don't want to drive because I don't want to ever take the chance of ever being in an accident and accidentally inflicting harm on anybody else. So I don't want to even be near that, so I don't drive. Okay. On the other hand, when people sometimes have to come and pick me up, then it's more pollution. Yeah? And taking care of the environment should be a foremost concern. If we have compassion for sentient beings, we should be compassionate towards the environment sentient beings live in. So then do you drive or don't you drive? And do you let young monastics drive? You know, when the mind isn't so controlled and the temptation is just to get in the car and go somewhere. So there's all different sorts of things like this. And what about internet use? Yeah? You can learn a lot about the Dharma through the internet. You can also get into a lot of trouble. Yeah? I mean, I know one monk in India, he disrobed because he was in a chat room and met a woman, and you know, that's how he met his wife. Yeah, so you don't kind of want the young ones doing that. Yeah? On the other hand, you know, at the Abbey, you know, we just got a big chipper for the forest, and we had to go online to order it. Okay. So, you know, how do you make a balance whereby there's responsible use of the internet without people's minds just getting taken over by the computer. Right? All of these sorts of things, quite fascinating actually, for us to discuss and think about, and that's real practical Buddhism, whether you're a monastic or a layperson. Okay, because, you know, the same principles apply. I mean, if you're trying to have a clear mind in your meditation, you don't want to be surfing the internet all day long and, you know, looking at this ad and, ordering things from this company and that company and stuff like that. So how do we, how even as lay students, what kind of relationship do you have with the computer? Huh? Because even when you read the news on the computer, how many ads are they? Are there? And the ads are much flashier than the actual text of the news you're reading. It takes a lot of concentration to read the news and not look at the ads, doesn't it? Yeah? That could actually maybe make that a practice. You know, go a whole week and don't look at any ads. And, you know, make a concerted effort when you're on the internet not to look at an ad. Never mind what's flashing. Don't even move your eyes. If it's flashing, don't go there. Yeah? Just keep with what you have to do. See how it is. Okay. So, and then I did my presentation in the evening. And I was, I showed the video about the Abbey. Most of you have seen that. And then I talked about how we were setting up. And people were really quite happy to hear about what's going on. And especially, you know, when I said that we're going to have the full ordination and for the women and everything like that. So people were quite happy. Then the next day, we had a panel on seniority and leadership styles. And that was really interesting. You know, because here's where you have the whole thing of senior monastics and junior monastics, because the Buddha set it up with mutual responsibilities there. You have the whole thing with your teacher and the teacher-disciple relationship. And so some of the nuns from City of 10,000 Buddhas, they were talking about how their teacher guided the disciples. And they were really saying that, you know, for their teacher, it was fine if you made a mistake. You know, nothing wrong with making a mistake, but it was very important that you learned from the mistake. Yeah? So we had some discussion about that. And then one of the Theravada nuns gave an analogy of horses. This is what her teacher had used, and said there's two ways to tame a horse. One is you just have your whip and you put the horse in a narrow space and you just get it in, you know, you're there until the horse realizes that you're boss. Okay, and then you ride the horse. And then the other way is the horse is in a big area and you just kind of hang out in the area with the horse for the while, you know. Then the area gets a little smaller and you're still hanging out. And anyway, there's a thing of familiarity that grows between the horse trainer and the horse until finally the horse trusts the horse trainer, who can then mount it. The difference is that when the fence is taken away, the horse that was trained via the whip, when there's no fence, that horse is going to run away and not come back. The horse that was trained by familiarity might run away, but it's going to come back. Yeah. But then we were talking, and you know, people have so many different types of personalities that you can't relate to them in the same way. You know, because some students you need to speak very directly to and very clearly to, and other students you need to be, you know, more like this. Yeah? And it's all really very skillful means. And we were talking about how, you know, and we found this in all of our traditions. In the Tibetan tradition, it's called Lama Says. In the Thai, it's Achan Says. In the Chinese, it's Sifu Says. In the Japanese, it's Roshi Says. And the whole thing that sometimes a teacher may give a specific instruction to a specific individual, and then it gets taken out of context, and people use it as a general instruction for everybody. Lama said we should do, but it was just an instruction given to that particular individual in that particular case. Okay? And so how do we work with that, and how do we tell what's a personal instruction? How do we tell what's most meant for the group? Yeah. Well, you can usually think if you're the only one in the room that it's a personal one. Okay. And if there's a lot of people in the room, you should also think it's a personal one. Okay. But there's the famous story of how Achen Sa, he's a Thai master, how he described it, which is, if you have a path, and on each side of the path there's cliffs, if somebody is on this side of the path going too close to this cliff, the person, the guide is going to say, go left, go left. If the person's too close to the left side, the guide's going to say, go right, go right. If you take it out of context, the teacher's giving contradictory advice. But if you know the context in the individual, then you see that the advice is spot on. So there was, you know, this whole, that was a very interesting topic. And then in the yesterday afternoon, Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is this wonderful Theravada monk in the Sri Lankan tradition. He's American from Brooklyn. And he's translated a great deal of the Pali Canon and is an excellent teacher. He wasn't able to come to the conference because he has some health difficulties. So, but we wanted him to give a talk, and so he called, and we had like a conference call thing. So we were all, telephone was in the middle, representing the Kubodi, and we were all sitting around. And he gave this absolutely incredible talk. And I just want to share some of the major points of this talk with you, because I think there's just a lot in it. The theme of this talk was challenges to monasticism, you know, in the 21st century. Because he said his feeling is that the situation we face now is so different than any other time in the past. And a large part of our situation is due to the values that came out in the 18th century European Enlightenment. You know, the idea of human rights, the idea of equality and democracy, and, you know, so many different things that came out of that. And he says, and so he says there's actually many, many ways in which Buddhism is being challenged, and especially monasticism, which is the tradition, you know, a key part of traditional Buddhism. There's many ways that they're being challenged, but he selected four that he thought were quite prominent. And so I'll just share those with you. The first one was the idea of diversity. Okay? And here, what he spoke about principally was diversity between that there's monastics and there's lay people. Because in traditional Buddhism, yeah, the monastics were the ones who really did the study and the practice. And the idea was that lay people were, you know, earning their career, and literacy wasn't so widespread in previous centuries. And so the lay people practiced generosity, they practiced ethical conduct, and they did a little bit of meditation. But nowadays, you have the situation that's very different. I mean, look at you people. You know, some of you have been coming and studying for years. You have daily meditation practices. You go on retreats. You know, there's many lay teachers now, and so it's really challenging the traditional lifestyle and the traditional way that the Buddhist community was organized. Yeah. What he didn't speak about there, but I think is another element in diversity, is that you have women becoming more prominent in Buddhism. Because in previous times, women were very much marginalized from the institutions. They were the ones who offered the help and the support, but now that's beginning to change. So that, especially, it, you know, influences Buddhism as a whole and monasticism in particular. The second point was secularization. Okay? And so you can really see, you know, how, you know, in ancient time, even in ancient Europe, and in all ancient societies, not ancient meaning 2,000 years ago, but, you know, in most societies, 300, 400, 500 years ago, religion was the core, wasn't it? You know, whatever the religion was, it was the core of the community that provided the values, provided the identity, provided the guidance, the center, you know, the monastery or whatever religion it was, the church, you know, it was where people went for education. It was the center of their social life. You know, now Western society, and increasingly every society, is becoming more and more secular. Yeah, and so religion doesn't have that same prominent position. Like in old Tibet, if you wanted an education, and if you weren't from the noble class, the only way to get the education was in the monastery. You know, secular schools, they weren't. Yeah? So, this is a really huge change. So how does secularization affect how Buddhism is taught? Yeah? And so he was saying that now you see that the aims of religion become much more focused on immediate effects. Okay? Because the tradition is more that the purpose was attaining nirvana, attaining enlightenment, and so that's why the monastic community really took the lead, because they had the time and the teachings and everything, the lack of worldly responsibility to aim for the goal of nirvana and enlightenment. But now with the secularization and with the busyness of our life, people want something from the Dharma that really works for them right now. And many people aren't so interested in nirvana and enlightenment. You know? And so meditation is getting taught to handle stress. It's getting taught to, as a way to deal with chronic pain. You know, they're using it for eating disorders. People come often, you know, to the Dharma Center because they want to learn to get along with people better. You know, nirvana, what's that? That's a band. You know, samsara is a perfume. Yeah, we come to the Dharma Center not to escape samsara and get nirvana, but just, you know, give me something so that I can just have a better life now. So what does that do to Buddhism when Dharma centers become prominent instead of monasteries, and the focus shifts to more immediate goals instead of the long-term goals of liberation and enlightenment? What happens then? Interesting, isn't it, to think about? Then the third factor was social engagement. Yeah. And so there's more and more a cause, and I think this comes out in some way from the secularization of society, there's more and more call now for religious people to engage in social movements. So you have liberation theology, you have, you know, in the Catholic Church. Well, the Catholic Church has had, you know, such a long history of engaging with schools and hospitals and things like that. But, you know, in traditional Buddhist countries, not so much, you know. I mean, the temple was the center of education, but they, you know, they didn't go build schools for all the the village kids. And the temples in some way were the hospitals, in the sense that when people had trouble, you went to the temple and received a blessing, you know, or got a holy pill, or, you know, some puja for health problems. But now it's very different. And people want, society wants religious people to go out and do something, you know. And so what happens to the meditation practice that you need to do to develop realizations when there's a lot of this societal encouragement to open a school or do this or do that or even get involved politically? Yeah? Different societies have different views about whether monastics should be politically involved or not. But you know what? It changes the way Buddhism is practiced, isn't it? Yeah? And so how do we deal with that as monastics? Yeah. Or how do we deal with it as a lay community when people, you know, say, you know, why are you going on a retreat for a week to look at your belly button? You know, why don't you go, you know, work and do some volunteer work and actually help somebody? Yeah. And many people feel real uneasy finding an answer to that question so that they feel comfortable with their spiritual practice, which is really important that they do. Okay, so that's the third challenge. And then the fourth challenge was the whole idea of interfaith and interspirituality. You know, in olden times, people belonged to one religion. Yeah? Nowadays, you have Jubus, you have Christian Buddhists, you know, you have people who are from other religions who practice a little bit of Buddhism. You have people who are kind of Buddhist but still go to church. You have this whole blending now in people's own lives and individual practices. Not everybody does it, but there's more and more of a movement towards this that there certainly wasn't in previous times. Yeah. So how does that affect how Buddhism is practiced? How does that affect monastic life? Yeah. Interesting question, isn't it? So so those were the points that he brought up. And then he was saying, you know, he said, I don't have any solutions to these. And of course, in any group, you're going to have a diversity of reactions to these. So there are going to be some people who are very conservative and so who say, for example, you know, you just keep the precepts very strictly. You don't handle money. You don't drive. You keep the very conservative element, just how Buddhism was practiced in a few centuries ago. You keep it exactly like that. Then there's going to be other people who are going to rewrite everything, yeah, and change everything around. And then what, you know, how about the middle way? And what is the middle way? And is there more than one middle way? Because it's interesting, amongst the various monastic traditions that we had there, you know, some groups were really conservative in some areas, but much more relaxed in other areas. Yeah, and much more relaxed in this area, but more conservative in that one. It's really fascinating. So people are going to find a whole diversity of how they structure their communities and their practice. Yeah? But it's definitely a time of change. Yeah? And I even see it, you know, in the Asian communities, because, for example, the Tibetans are in exile now. So they're or even in, you know, the Tibetans who remain in Tibet, you know, they have to deal with, you know, Chinese government and modern society. And the ones in India have to deal with Indian society and modern society. And, you know, in Korea and Japan, everywhere, everybody's in the process of modernization. And I think also, actually, this is one of the things that's happening in the Islamic countries, and that the fundamentalism we sometimes see is one reaction to modernity. Yeah, I mean, you find this whenever there's a lot of social change. Some people get very, you know, yeah, there's so many different reactions to modernity. And so Buddhism is in Buddhist countries are in that same process. You know, even the Asian countries, let alone when Buddhism comes here, where we have such a hodgepodge of everything. So anyway, these were the kinds of topics that we were talking about. And then last night, what we did is we shared how we shared some of our chanting and some of our music, and how we use music and chanting to convey Buddhism. So it began with the Shasta Adin folks, and their founder, who is no longer alive, she knew all about Gregorian chant. So they do Buddhist prayers in Gregorian chant. And you go in their meditation hall, and, you know, up in the corner, there's an organ. And it just sounds like the organ. And then, you know, they're doing the Gregorian chant, but it's Buddhist words. It's really fascinating. So they were chanting first, okay? And then Reverend Hinshaw, he does a lot of Buddhist type of folk songs. I mean, he takes American, sometimes he took melodies from American folk songs and made Buddhist words. And sometimes he just made up his own folk song kind of music. And he's there with his guitar, you know, like this, you know, with different, you know, dedication prayers. And he's even made a CD, which he'll send out to people for free if they do a kind act. You have to do a kind act and write in and tell him what it is, and then he'll send you a free CD. It's really nice. Isn't that sweet? And it's a very nice idea. So he was doing that. Then the people from Deer Park, Thich Nhat Hanh's group, you know, then they had some prayers that they did with a guitar, you know, that were more kind of sing-along prayers. And then they had a really nice way of doing the Heart Sutra that was much more meditative. They did some of their things. And then Srivasti Abbey, we just Star Spangled Compassion. And that, everybody just laughed. I mean, have all of you heard Star Spangled Compassion? Oh, we'll have to do it together. It's on YouTube. You can go to YouTube and look it up. With the Srivasti Abbey Monastic Choir. Yeah, but everybody really liked that. So it was just a wonderful, wonderful conference, you know. And just the kind of spirit of people from different traditions coming together, really listening, really helping each other, learning from each other, talking about things of mutual interest and challenges that we faced. You know, many people who had difficulties in their practice or in their community, you know, in the break times, we were, you know, they talked with other people to seek guidance from, you know, how do you handle this situation in your community, or how do you handle this in your practice? So it's really, really lovely spirit and way of people coming together. Yeah. So that's why I wanted to spend a whole session telling you about it. You know? Because I hope you didn't mind. but just because I think it's just a very historic kind of thing that happened. And, you know, there were only 35 of us there, plus the surrounding Shasta Abbey community. So, okay, so maybe you have some questions, comments? Yeah?
Could you address maybe, what about like tons of yogis and yoginis in the West? How does that fit in?
Okay, so how do tantric yogis and yoginis fit in the West? That's a good question. You know, you have to look at the whole way Tantra is being practiced now, because now Tantra is very, very public. In ancient India, it wasn't public at all. You know, nobody put out a flyer saying, "I'm a yogi. I'm giving an initiation. Come for $99.99." You know, nobody did that in ancient times. Now Tantra is very public. So, you know, it's a really very, very different kind of situation. Yeah. Well, I think that's some of the thing between monastics and lay, you know, because there's this whole history of tantric yogis being lay people, and so that's passed into the West, and so some of those people are teachers. Yeah. And so some people want to go towards a lay teacher who doesn't do Tantra. Some people want to go to a lay teacher who does do Tantra. Some people want to have monastic teachers. People are going to, you know, choose how whatever their disposition is.
I was really surprised what we normally do is how we go to a whole lot of monasteries,
mm-hmm.
a whole lot of monasteries.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was very surprised was the nun of several different nunneries, that they would harvest their crops
mm-hmm.
and take them to the villages. And they take them to the animals down below. And when animals couldn't survive with villagers or the farmers, they took them in. And they took care of them
mm-hmm.
and they died. And what I did see is many monasteries and nunneries, in fact, one of my favorite nunneries, is really far away. So what they would do is, as you do, you know, well, you don't, but as you mentioned, that they would send someone, people would give donations to them, and then they would send someone down for provisions, and then they'd come up and they'd have to take care of the trucks because they were far up in the mountains where villagers could not come by. And that was very distinctly different what I saw to that than what I saw in Tom, which is where the villagers were closer and could bring things, whereas it seemed like they were far apart. But what I really came away with seeing is like at one point, like a very high Lama came down and did blessings, and then spent a day and were giving a lot of meals. But what I did see, a lot of the monasteries and nunneries providing sustenance to the villagers and to the farmers.
Oh, wow.
And we have pictures, I mean, they actually harvested. I mean, they were out harvesting. In fact, mm-hmm. one of them cut her hand, she had a band-aid, and I was walking by, so I gave her a band-aid, and she said, okay, now that I provided that, I would show how. In her life, I'm related to her somehow, I don't really know what, but it was quite spicy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a real good way of how things had to change, because in pre-59 Tibet, the monasteries were the land owners, and the people worked the land, and then they had to pay tax in the form of grain to the monasteries. With the communist government, that changed, you know. So very much different kind of system now. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah.
I wonder if you have some thoughts. The challenge that you mentioned about the idea of traditionally the Buddhist said we aim towards divine enlightenment, mm-hmm. but the idea of meditation for reducing stress and things like that. And I wonder about your thoughts on that. For instance, I think about working with anger,
mm-hmm.
your book,
mm-hmm.
Which can appeal to certainly non-Buddhists easily as much as Buddhists, because people have anger whether they're Buddhist or not. And have you thought about that? You probably have thought about that.
Yeah.
The juxtaposition of those things of drawing people in sometimes to then
talk
about something that they're totally unfamiliar with. So,
right. Okay, So that whole question of is it necessarily bad to teach? Is there the implication that it's bad to teach Buddhism just for immediate gains in this life? No. You know, I mean, if people can learn the Dharma and benefit this life, fantastic. Buddha taught so that people would benefit and attain, you know, and he wanted sentient beings to be happy, you know, in samsara and, of course, out of samsara. Yeah? So there's nothing wrong with using Buddhism for creating human happiness in samsara and happiness of this life. There's nothing wrong with it. You know, we should do that. And like you said, like my book, Working with Anger, is a good example of that. Very often, you use those kinds of things of working with emotions or stress or pain because it's a way for people to learn something about Buddhism even though they aren't Buddhists. And they, not something about Buddhism, scratch that, okay? To learn something that's useful to them without becoming Buddhists. And then when they benefit from having learned that thing that's useful to them, then they may say, where did that come from? And then when they hear Buddhism, then they may want to learn more about Buddhism and become interested in nirvana and enlightenment as the final goal. So, some, you know, teaching in that kind of way can be a skillful means to draw people in and slowly lead them towards a higher goal. And it basically, I mean, what I always think of, because lots of times when I go to teach, when I'm a guest teacher at a center, I usually just talk on some kind of general topic because I don't know the people so well. I don't know their level. There's usually a lot of new people, some old people. So I want them to have something they can take away and apply in their life right now. So I don't necessarily talk about liberation and enlightenment. I want to give them something, you know, that they can use right now, because in using that, then they will not create so much negative karma. They'll create some positive karma. And whether they believe in karma or not, that will definitely help their rebirth. Okay, so I think what when things become shaky is when you stop teaching nirvana and enlightenment and focus only on the immediate benefits in this life. That's not so good, because then you're depriving the people who have the karma to learn about the higher aims from getting the teachings on those higher aims.
Mm-hmm. So that even if you just use Buddhism as in your everyday life and studied the precepts and you just did that, mm-hmm. that you could almost attain nirvana by accident. You know, and you would spread so much goodwill. I mean, you would mm-hmm. because you wouldn't be. You would be helping other people not to suffer. I mean, mm-hmm. there would be so many benefits.
Yeah.
It isn't like taking a medication for the wrong reason, you know, getting high instead of getting well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like it could only bring you good.
Yeah.
And bring everybody around you good, too.
Definitely, definitely. She is saying, if people practice for the immediate benefit of this life, it only brings good. You're absolutely correct. There's never any harm in that.
And couldn't you just attain nirvana by accident? Not even,
quite that, I don't think so. No. No. Because, oh, you're disappointed. I'm sorry.
That's more honorable.
Yeah. No, because there's certain, because attaining nirvana, the basis is the precepts. The basis is that living a kind life and being kind to others. But there's many more in-depth practices that you have to learn, different ways of working with your mind. You have to develop single-pointed concentration. You have to realize the nature of emptiness. You have to have a determination to leave samsara and have no interest in the glories and pleasures of samsara. So those kinds of other realizations are also needed in addition to being an ethical, kind person.
But don't you think if you meditate and you work in mindfulness that these things would gradually come to you?
I think you need a teacher to teach them to you. If they gradually came to us without us having to learn them, we would have been enlightened by now, don't you think? We've had beginningless lives.
But I'm thinking that
I'm
thinking that once you started on this path,
uh-huh.
even if you just started it because you needed to get along better with your neighbor,
uh-huh.
that eventually, you know, you would be working with a teacher. I mean, these because you would have gone to a teacher for the very things that we're talking about.
Okay. Okay, so if you start out wanting just to get along better with your neighbor, wouldn't you eventually get to the point where you made a link with a teacher and you learn more? My experience is many people come to DFF and they may want to get along with their neighbor, and when they learn how to get along with their neighbor, they're satisfied. Okay? Now, of course, it's true. They've had contact with the Dharma. Seeds have been planted in their life. For sure, those seeds are going to ripen in a future life. Okay? But in terms of this life's practice, they're just kind of satisfied with what they got, and that's good enough. You know, so eventually, if you can take future lives into consideration because of the good seeds they got this life, eventually those seeds will ripen and they'll meet the Dharma again in a future life, and maybe then they'll be more interested in the other goals. But, you know, many people are, you know, kind of satisfied with right now. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it, because they've only benefited. They've only benefited from the Dharma. And like you said, it's benefited all the other people around them, too. Mm-hmm. It'd be nice if you could attain Nirvana by accident. You know? But we need to put in more concerted effort. Yeah.
I've always wondered about this. Tibetan nuns, not from the Tibetan tradition, mm-hmm. cannot attain full ordination
mm-hmm.
through the Tibetan tradition, and so you have to walk to China, or to somewhere where you
yeah.
are fully in the Chinese tradition. And I wonder what that means for people who continue to practice in the Tibetan tradition. Is that, other than the social and political implications for Tibetans in Tibet, or in just
how it's different in terms of, is it a precept different, is Vinaya different, or are there other aspects that affect your ordination that would be different here? Okay. Other than, you know, I know there are many others. Yeah. Okay, so you're asking that if you go and get the Vinaya lineage, let's say from the Chinese tradition, but your main practice is in the Tibetan tradition, does that affect your main practice in any way? I don't think whether it's the Dharmagupta Vinaya lineage that's practiced in China or the Mulusavastavada one that's practiced in Tibet, I don't think one way or the other it's going to influence your basic practice so much, because you still have the foundation of precepts of ethical conduct, you know, and though your monastic ordination governs your actions of body and speech, whereas your Dharma practice is moving into more your meditation practice. Okay? So I haven't found any kind of conflict or any disparity or anything like that in any way. In fact, I found that taking the Bhikshuni ordination has actually improved my hold on the practice in general. Yeah, because it's made me feel much more responsible. Yeah. And, of course, you have more precepts, so you become more mindful. Yeah. Right?
I'm just intrigued by the concept of the different Buddhist traditions getting together for this kind of annual conference. And one of the challenges that a lot of folks that don't understand the variety of Buddhist traditions is, who are the qualified teachers and how do you identify them?
Yeah.
And so there's a misunderstanding, and I'll use an example of people saying, well, what's the difference between this and like the Bhagavan Rajneesh back in, you know,
yeah.
Right? Uh-huh. It's very hard to just kind of say, well, there's a guru with a huge following and a lot of attention at that time, but at some point, you know, the integrity went out of that community, and it wasn't like, you know, other qualified teachers showed up and said, oh, you know, stop paying attention to that. Do you have the ability, or I would think maybe the interest within your community of saying there are qualified teachers and there are not qualified teachers, or that there's ways to, you know, inform the non-informed community?
Of qualified and unqualified teachers and of letting other people know and things like that. That's a very delicate issue because, like I said, there's no central certifying body. And even in the Catholic Church where there is a central certified body, does it work? Yeah? Okay, or in the big mega churches. Yeah, does that work? Doesn't work. So it's always a thing of, it's really the student's responsibility to check their teachers very well. Or not their teachers, check potential teachers very well. Okay? So, you know, it's really our responsibility when we go to get to know, you know, what is somebody like and how do they keep their precepts and what do they teach and what's their relationship with their own teacher like and, you know, how do they act towards other people and, you know, and to really investigate. And on the basis of our own investigation, which can take a period of time, there's no rush. You don't need to walk in and 5 minutes later say, this guy seems nice, he's my guru, you know. I mean, Tisha spent 12 years checking out Lama Tsarlingpa. That's kind of long, you know. But the idea is that it's our responsibility and we should do that. And yeah?
I mean, one of the examples in Western Church right now, right, is that this huge schism over gay marriage, right, or the role of gay people in variety of denominations, and so there's this schism. And that seems to be almost an impossible kind of schism within Buddhism. But maybe I'm wrong. I mean, maybe, you know, if some issue like that came up, would Buddhist practice change? Or, you know, would you have some kind of conference to say, oh, was this some misunderstanding here?
Okay, so you're asking like on some social issues, let's say gay marriage, is that something that could potentially divide the Buddhist community? I think the way people tend to do things is different people will have different opinions and everybody will just have their own ideas and run their own communities according to their own ideas. And I think this is, in some ways, it's the advantage and disadvantage of not having central structure. The advantage is that you could have this diversity, you know, without forming one rule that, you know, one size fits all. On the other hand, by having this diversity, you do allow the potential for all sorts of things to go on. So it's...
This isn't so much a question as it is, I'm just thinking about and observing how young people like them, and I'm a little childhood age and getting to be a preteen, is that there's discussions that happen in our home when people even look at pictures of monastics with your picture up and different pictures up. And the question is that, like last night, there were... Sorry, I didn't want to get on this tangent, but last night, one of them's friends asked Emma, why is your mom's hair so short? And she goes, oh, you'll never guess. And she said, because she wants to look like a guy. She says, no, she wants to be a nun, but I think they'd arrest her. She wants to be a what? What? What are you talking about? So we had this discussion with people that had no... I mean, I was kind of embarrassed, you know. These are people that are none, and so then they assume Catholic none. Mm-hmm. And so then it got to be this really quiet and incredible discussion about monasticism and Buddhism and how, you know, this is a tradition and this is what happens. And so we end up talking about this.
With the children or with the adults?
With the children and with the adults. And
wow.
I wonder how often these kinds of discussions happen with, you know, just secular society. And people were like, offended. They were like, really? I had no idea. And so then I was thinking, you know, it's so wonderful what you're doing, Shavasti, and how, I mean, just to have, like, an in-service for just, like, everything you wanted to know about a monastic but was afraid to ask.
Yeah.
Street corner with a sign, but people just they just don't know. And yet, when it was over, like, the kids were like, wow. Mm-hmm. You know, and then that the question, do they have internet? So what do they do? And then do they text message? Another way in which to get this information. But how you saw in this young mind, like, wow, you know, there's this other way of things.
Yeah, that they never even dreamt of before, you know.
So it's really great.
I was at my parents' house last weekend, and one of their friends came over who's raising her granddaughter, who's about 5 years old. And the grandmother said to me, you know, when we were coming over here, my granddaughter asked me what you did for a living. And I said, she's a nun. But I didn't know how to explain that. How do you explain a nun to a 5-year-old? What do you do all day? And so the child was there, so I said, well, basically what I try and do is cultivate a kind heart and work on myself to become a nicer person. That was the simplest explanation I could think of that a 5-year-old would understand. Huh? I have to boil it down. Yeah, but it is interesting. How do you inform the rest of society who, you know, may never know?
I had a question about at the conference that you were at, that you talked about how people were talking about how to engage more young people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was also wondering, was there any talk or discussion about how to engage people from different cultures in Buddhism and in Buddhism, you know, groups and monastic systems and all this? So was there any discussion about
that? So the question is, how to, was there any discussion about engaging people from different cultures?
Yes, specifically, especially in the West and the U.S., because there's so many different, you know, ethnic groups and cultures and stuff where they may not be in some of the other Asian countries.
Right.
But here, there's just so many.
So many. We didn't talk about it at this particular conference. I have been at conferences of Western Buddhist teachers where it came up. And there's many different feelings about that, you know. Some I know down in the Bay Area, they formed the Spirit Rock people. They're a lay group. They started some kind of council, something about, like, for people of color, something like that. I've never thought of doing that because I've never needed to. Yeah, and I think one of the reasons is, and some of the other groups, you know, they have councils about how to relate to the Asians. I don't need a council, I go to Asian monasteries, I feel completely at home. I don't need to have a formal meeting. Yeah. And, so personally speaking, I've never done that. And also, I think there has to be an element of respect for other cultures too, because many of these other cultures have their own primary religion, and to go in and try and convert people, I don't think is very respectful of other people's cultures. I think making Buddhism broadly available, maybe that's what it is, you know, making it available so that people of many cultures can hear about it, and then those people who want to come can come. That's a good way to do it. But, you know, forming I don't know, that a council with, well, we're going to try and, you know, do more with this community, to me that doesn't feel so respectful of the principal values and maybe native religion, the foremost religion of a particular community. What do you think about it?
I was just wondering about this because I know the symbol school is circles, like you can, in my experience, you tend to see some of the same types of people from the same cultures, same socioeconomic class.
And I mean, this is a whole other issue in Buddhism. It's the classism. And I think that happens a lot because many centers charge for teachings and retreat centers charge for things. And that sets up a class structure within Buddhism of the people who can afford it and the people who can't. And I've always been very much against that, you know, because Buddhism is for everybody. And it should be made available to everybody. And then people should give out of the goodness of their own hearts as they feel fit according to their own economic situation. One thing I thought that was very nice about Seeds of Compassion and when His Holiness was here was that all the tickets were free. And they also made a very concerted effort to go into all sorts of communities that never would have had contact with a project like this or with the Dalai Lama. You know, and I thought that was really quite wonderful that they did that. Okay, shall we sit quietly? You just think about what we talked about so that you can take it home and remember it.